the last talk, the title Christ, the emphasis is upon the anointed one who is promised right through the Old Testament. The emphasis is not as if you had given the title Jesus on his saving humanity, or the title Lord of his kingship and rule, but the emphasis on the word Christ, Christos, the anointed one, promised throughout the Old Testament, is on that. And so what I was asked to do, whether you know whether I was asked to do it or not, is to summarize the Old Testament. Now, I really tried a bit of that a fortnight ago in a sweeping introduction to the Old Testament, or most of it, from, I think, Moses to Christ, to put Jeremiah in his setting, and also as a preliminary canter for today. And I gave descriptive titles. By the way, I'm going to keep my manuscript pretty closely, because if I turn aside and do more than give you scriptural references, we'll never get finished. And I'm told that I have to get finished. I'll give you the references, and some of them are so significant that you would need to note them either in here or on something else. I gave a fortnight ago descriptive titles to some of the main Old Testament characters, such as, and here's a list of them: Moses, the founder of the nation; Joshua, the builder of the nation; Samuel, the restorer of the nation after the backsliding in the book of Judges following the death of Joshua; David and Solomon as the dual types of Christ, as respectively victor, David, and enjoyer, Solomon, of God's blessing on Israel. Didn't use these words last week, but I'm using them now. Elijah, the militant romantic. Elisha, the patient idealist. These two significant types, as I said last a fortnight ago, and we'll come to this, I hope, at the climax, significant types of John the Baptist and Jesus. Compare the difference in their characters and their temperaments and their personalities, for that's significant for the whole Old Testament story. There's a great lot in that, and we're going to look at the close, I hope we'll have time for this, at Matthew chapter 11, 1-6, and 12, 14-21. All right, then, that's Elijah and Elisha. That's really, in a sense, the core of what I have to say, building up to Christ. Then Isaiah, the realist visionary, foreseeing, and this also is very, very important, related to Elijah and Elisha, foreseeing the reduction of Israel from a nation to a remnant. If you don't get the remnant idea about the Old Testament, you miss, in a sense, you miss the whole point. If you don't understand that, you don't understand the Old Testament, and therefore you can't understand the New. So this is what we're going to drive home to our minds tonight about the remnant. Isaiah, then, the realist visionary, foreseeing the reduction of Israel to a remnant, yet envisaging the glory of Christ's kingdom, of course, especially in the later chapters. Then, 100 years later on, Jeremiah, who was the subject of my former study, the denouncing or devastating visionary through whom God commanded the Jews to get out of his sight to captivity. Then I filled in a good few names, both before and after Malachi, last Thursday's subject, such as the visionaries Daniel and Ezekiel, prophesying in Babylon, Esther and Mordecai in Shushan, Persian capital east of Babylon, Ezra rereading what I call the Divine Riot Act to the returned exiles in the forecourt of the temple area in Jerusalem, Ezra chapter 10, Nehemiah patching the city wall, chapters 2-6 of Nehemiah, the Jews much later in Egypt pouring over their tomes in Alexandria and translating the Old Testament from the Hebrew into the Greek, into the Septuagint, LXX, the translation of the 70, the scholars. The universal language, of course, was Greek after Alexander's conquest. Then, a century and a half before Christ, Judas Maccabeus, that great Jewish patriot, resisting Antiochus Epiphanes from Syria, from Damascus, and there in the mid-second century B.C., running up to John the Baptist and Christ, the new evangelical party, the Pharisees, believers in the resurrection and in the supernatural, over against the sacerdotal rationalists, the Sadducees. Then the ascetic Essenes, to complete the picture, the faithful Jews of Qumran, the texts and all that, the monastery, if they were different from the Essenes, I don't know, and I don't know if anybody knows, to John the Baptist and his cousin Messiah himself. Well, that's what I tried to do as an introduction to Jeremiah last week. Start again then, not with Adam, as you did. Now, next few sentences, listen closely, because I've telescoped a whole lot that goes a little beyond assured knowledge, and lots of the scholars wouldn't touch this, but that doesn't frighten me. Listen to this carefully. This is a reconstruction of the origins of evil, which Tom Torrance says nobody's any business to inquire into because it's a mystery. Well, but I'm inquiring into it nonetheless. Start again, not with Adam as you did, but with the angels, probably created first. Job 38:7, Nehemiah 9:6, Genesis 1:1, the heavens were created before the earth. The angels then, probably created first, one of whom, probably an archangel, when the universe had been created, God appointed as its ruler. The ruler of this world, the prince of this cosmos, that's the universe. Now, scriptures for that Satan is the ruler of this world, John 12:31, 14:30, 16:11, three times Jesus calls him the prince of this world. Paul calls him that once, the prince of the power of the air, Ephesians 2:2. And just read the Lucan account of the temptation, chapter 4, verses 5 to 8, to see that Satan himself says to Jesus, and Jesus doesn't contradict him, that he had given him authority over the whole universe. He had been given authority over the whole universe. Says there quite plainly. Look for 5 to 8. But nonetheless, he, Lucifer, rebelled through pride and was cast out of heaven. And although Derek Kidner doesn't like this, or says that it's precarious to read the fall of Satan into Ezekiel 28:12 following, and Isaiah 14:12 following, two mnemonics there, by the way, 28 and 14, and then the 2:12s, I think there are hints of that very thing. He rebelled through pride and was cast out of heaven, but was not dismissed from his post, his position, as ruler of the universe, Lucifer, the angel. Whereupon man, having been created as the climax of all things, and also appointed ruler of the universe, note this, Genesis 1:26-27, and therefore Lucifer's rival as governor of the universe, man is seduced by Satan, who is then with malignity invested with double authority as the ruler of this universe. This is the sequence. Now, you can argue about it. Tom Swanson and I argued on the phone the other day about whether the governorship of the universe begins with Adam in Genesis 1:26-27, and then was lost to Satan by the fall. I said I didn't. I think so. I thought that God had given to Lucifer, if the angels were created first, which these texts suggest, gave him authority over the universe and didn't take it away from him when he rebelled and was cast out. And God appointed a rival manager. And the devil said, "Who's he? Who's this creature, Adam?" And so he promptly got him under his wing. And that's why I say he was invested with a kind of a double authority. As the ruler of the universe, as Lucifer, and then with Adam within his power. Hence God's dilemma. Now that's the sort of thing, you see, you need to think about and think about and think about for ages, and we could discuss it. We'd really need a few hours discussion after this, because I'm just throwing out things that could take ages to unfold. Hence God's dilemma in Genesis 3. What's God's dilemma? Well, he'd had two seeming defeats. His creature Lucifer had rebelled against him, and the crown of creation, the only creature made in the image of God, man, has gone over to the enemy's camp. And God has suffered two seeming defeats. And here's a dilemma in Genesis 3. He could have wiped out the whole thing then and started again. Or wiped out the whole thing and not started again. He was complete in himself, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and didn't need to create as he chose. But he chose to suffer these so-called defeats, and to show his divine brilliance, or glory, that's a more reverent term, he planned the redemption of man and the universe, not the devil, since pure spirits gone wrong are unsavable. Now, whether I've got the sequence right here or not, and I'm open to correction every moment because I want the truth, whatever it is, whether I've got the sequence of all that right or wrong, since this is an attempted reconstruction of the whole thing, all the elements I've mentioned are necessary to justify the full meaning of the Old Testament part of the story, not to say the New Testament completion of the story of our redemption. The hinge of the whole thing is one almighty verse, Genesis 3:15. Get that right into the depth of your mind and never forget it. Memorize it and learn it and weigh every word of Genesis 3:15. And be looking at it while I chat. In which God prophetically vows vengeance on the devil for enslaving man, and says this: "I'll get you yet. I'll get you yet, you brute. I'll get you by putting enmity." Notice that this is very, very exciting. This is something that God did. "By putting enmity in the heart of man against you." And how will he put enmity in the heart of man against Satan and evil and sin? "By virtue of the gift of faith that God would give to man." You see? This was to be done, of course. The gift of faith was to be given, in a sense, climactically, with full and final potential, at the climax and watershed of history, of course, which is the coming of Christ and the work of Christ, the second Adam, who to the fight and to the rescue came. The power of whose victory, Christ's victory, over the devil and all evil, would therefore be retrospective. You see? The potential would go right back to Abel, the first man that Hebrews 11 says had faith. And right on through the Old Testament. All the Old Testament saints are saved by faith in Christ. There's nobody else to be saved by. There is salvation in no other, Acts 4:12. Abraham is saved by Christ. They're all saved by Christ. And the work of Christ which is eternal, as well as done in a pinpoint of history, you see, must be retrospective in its effect. Something happens, of course, where after Christ's work is done. The writer to the Hebrews speaks about just men made perfect, and Frederick Bruce says that's a distinction between the Old Testament saints before Christ's work and after. They're just before. They're perfect afterwards. We can't go into all that. But you see the point. The work of Christ is set at the peak of history, the watershed of history. And the effect of it to those who have faith, who have been given the gift of faith by God, including Abel and Abraham and all that, goes right back, you see, and forward. Right to us. Prospective as well as retrospective toward us and toward all men who believe, who shall follow us. Thus, you see, God overstrides the wreck in the Garden of Eden. And this is what he says to Satan. In the fullness of time I will beat you and snatch man out of your grasp and make him the true governor of the universe. I want a man to rule the universe, and I will do it by the introduction of another seed into the fallen human race. And of course we've hints of the new seed, which of course ultimately is Christ, as you know. Paul tells us that, touching upon Genesis 3:15. We've hints of that new seed in the seed of Abel, the godly brother, the new seed of Seth, Enoch, Noah and his sons, before coming to the first high peak of Old Testament history in Abram, whose descendants at last will reach their goal in the second Adam, who is the Redeemer of all things. You don't need me to stress the finality of the coming of Christ and the fact of Christ and the work of Christ, because over and over again, you see, both in the Old Testament, prophetically, and in the New Testament, thereafter, it speaks about the days following Christ as the last days. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that Christ's going to come. Well, he didn't come in the first century A.D., or the second, or the tenth, or the 15th, or the 19th so far. They may not come for thousands of years yet. But the last days means... there are different shades of meaning, of course, but it really means that God's final word has come. Hebrews 1:1. God has spoken finally. He's spoken by the prophets in the Old Testament, remember, in various fragments, partially. But in Jesus Christ, he said his last word. He's no more to say, and he's no more to give, and he's no more to do. It is finished, you see. And so, everything after that is the last days, the beginning of the end, the beginning of the endless end, if you like. The finality of Christ. And to get back to what I was saying here, we came to Abraham, coming to the first high peak of Old Testament history in Abraham, whose descendants at last will reach their goal in the second Adam, the Redeemer of all things. Thus we see the whole of the rest. This is very, very important. I find that these insights, recent insights that I've been carrying around with me for the last few months, are as helpful as anything I think I've given for years to young Christians who want to understand. The whole of the rest of Old Testament history from Genesis 3:15 is seen simply. You must see things simply to see them right and fully, you see. The whole of the rest of Old Testament history is seen as God's conflict with the devil. And the conflict is whether the seed which is to produce the vanquisher of Satan, namely Jesus Christ, the Messiah, is to be preserved or destroyed. God wants to preserve that seed right through the Old Testament, and the devil wants to destroy it so that Christ may not come. That's the whole point. Now, Doesn't that give a simple unity to the whole of the Old Testament? And boy, oh boy, we need a simple unity for the whole of the Old Testament. It's so various and diverse. Well, if we get that into our heads, then we can go on. Such an attitude to the Old Testament certainly puts an interpretation upon that larger part of the sacred volume, the Old Testament, above all interpretations. And the idea, you see, of the conflict between God and the devil, God preserving the seed through which Messiah is going to come and the devil trying to destroy it, you see, it runs as a thin red gold thread through the whole thing. And this is what I was seeking to do already in my introduction a fortnight ago and tonight. So that what I'm trying to give you is an introduction to the subject of Christ rather than a full discussion of Christ the person and his work. It's merely an introduction. You can go on to study the New Testament after this if you've gathered, if you've threaded through the Old Testament, you know what it's about. And you jolly well will know after tonight. But in trying to do this, I'm telling you who Christ is, as I never could if I tried to tell you merely from the gospel records onwards. I couldn't. I might tell you about Jesus. I might tell you about the Lord, you see, from Christ's death and victory and all that, from Paul and the rest of the apostles and the book of Revelation, all that. But I could never tell you about Christ if I started at the gospels. The one that should come, that is promised. You get that in the Old Testament. You see, it's the roots which produce fruit. Cut flowers may be beautiful, but they tell no story of their origins. We don't understand fully the miracle of their being and their beauty unless we know something about how they came to be and how they were produced. Hence your committee's attempts to faithfully indoctrinate you in origins. An attempt which today is frowned upon by many men in the church who want the gospel as a tiny New Testament pill, easy to swallow, without their having the faintest notion of what it contains. So, we proceed to run through the Old Testament. We haven't done it yet. seeing it from Genesis 3:15. Now, a word about that. If you can pick up a book, will it be here? Where did I get it? On Genesis 3 by E.J. Young of Westminster. Well, you bag it. E.J. Young, speaking on the uniqueness of this verse, Genesis 3:15, and quoting Luther, says, "This text contains within itself everything noble and glorious that is to be found anywhere else in the scriptures." Young asks whether this is too strong a statement and concludes that it points to the truth that the heart of the biblical message is found in this verse, Genesis 3:15, which he calls a unique verse. Well then, starting there, we see the evil seed of Cain and its product of worldly arts and crafts. Now notice, I'm not condemning arts and crafts, they're gifts of God, but worldly arts and crafts leading men astray from God, which they often do. They needn't do, but they often do. And adultery, in the same chapter, Genesis 4, arts and crafts and adultery and murder. What a chapter. With the new seed of Seth, the son in place of murdered Abel, at the end of chapter 4. Now, chapter 6 tells of a new recrudescence of evil due to the evil marriages we read of there. Now, a word about the evil marriages in Genesis 6. Whether these marriages were between fallen angels and women, producing monsters, which I believe, or whether between the godly line of Seth and women, which most of the scholars believe, although the whole story seems to me to impugn, look at it and see, the beginning of 6, seems to impugn the, quote, sons of God, which almost always in the Old Testament mean angels, seems to impugn the sons of God as authors of this new dimension of evil. And if we take it as the scholars take it, then it is Seth that's being impugned, you see, and not the women. The wickedness that followed, anyway, led to the judgment of the flood and God's saving act there anent, after which another new seed, that of Noah and his sons, sought to do God's will, supported after the flood by the Noahic covenant, Genesis 9:1-7. But both sin in man, which is Satan's foothold in man, and Satan himself behind the sin of man, trying to frustrate God in his production of a worthy bride for his son, namely the church, Old Testament church and New Testament church. The sin in man and Satan behind it reached a new high in wickedness in the Tower of Babel. Babylon is a symbol for wickedness right through the Bible to Revelation chapter 17 and 18. And God judged there at the Tower of Babel wicked men by confusing and confounding their tongues and scattering them. Now, all the time I'm running over these bits of history, the most significant bits of history I can find in the Old Testament, you're looking behind the events and the human actors in the dramas. You're looking for God and the devil. See, I got into an awful row some years ago. I've maybe told you this, certainly told some of you before. An awful row some years ago at Swanwick. They asked me to come down and speak about the devil at Swanwick. Two of the bigwigs of the Graduates Fellowship were sitting at coffee in Fleet Street and said, "Now we're going to have a conference on the subject of evil. Now who will we get to talk about the devil?" And one said, "Oh, Willie Steele, he knows a lot about the devil." So they invited me down, and I found that some of these big wigs, you know, were a little bit uncertain about the personality of the devil. And one of my fellow speakers, a younger chap than I, at the close of my first address, got hold. We were all gathered in the lounge together afterwards and discussing the whole day and what had been said. And he said, "You've read the devil into half of the Old Testament and more, whereas he appears very, very seldom in the Old Testament." And just for a moment I was floored in front of all these big Johnny, you know, Donald Mackay and all that. And then I said, "Do you mean to tell me that you need to see his name to discern him? He hides his name and hides himself, as though he were not there." And so I asked, where in the Old Testament, or any other testament for that matter, is the devil not to be seen and known and active? Absolutely. Everywhere. You see? And so, I want you to see this action, good and evil, God and the devil, through this history. Then comes the really new seed, Abram. And here also, as in all the race descended from Abraham, who is the father of those who have faith, you remember the father of the faithful, we see the conflict between sin and faith, or as it is ultimately, as I'm saying, between God and the devil, and the battle on the human battlefield for the prize, which is for the control of man. That's why the Old Testament itself exposes the sins of the Old Testament saints and the seductions of Satan lurking behind them, whereas the New Testament praises these very men as men of faith. Compare our Lord and the apostles, and especially the writer of the Hebrews in chapter 11. When you read in the New Testament, these men of the Old Testament mean praise David and Samuel and Moses and the like, you say, "Oh, we could," and cynics of course say, "We could tell another story about them." But that doesn't rule out the fact of their faith. And if what I'm trying to do is to have any effect on you and on me, then I must assume that as I recount the moral and spiritual ups and downs of these men, you are to see the constant tug of war going on between God and the devil as God proceeds to produce a race leading to Christ, and the devil tries to destroy that race before it can produce Christ. That's what the Old Testament, I maintain, is about. And if you really grasp that, you can go on and do the rest yourselves. Although I doubt if you will. Well, Abram starts by partly disobeying God and leaves Ur of the Chaldees, Persian Gulf, but takes, as God commanded him to do, but takes his family with him against God's command. Now, you'll never understand this unless you take two scriptures together, and they're very simple. Genesis 12, 1-3, and the beginning of Stephen's speech, Acts 7, 1-4. And you need to go back to the authorized version and find that the first statement in Genesis 12 and 1 is pluperfect. And you get it in the authorized version, but not in any of the rest of the versions. Now God had said to Abram. Because you see, earlier in the end of 11, Terah, his father, took into his head that he was going to Haran, away up beside the turn of the Euphrates. You know that you need a bit of geography here. You know the fertile crescent, the fertile bit, round from the north of Turkey, right down Syria, Palestine, right down, trails away into the Negev and the Egyptian desert. That's called the fertile crescent, you see. And very fertile at Sharon and the valley of Israelian and Jezreel down to Jordan. Now, and then beyond that, you've got the vast Arabian desert. And anyone who's going from the west to the east, say from Africa, or even from Palestine, to the east, would never go shooting right across the Jordan and across past Amman, and right across the Arabian desert. Nobody, it can be done, but they never did that. They went up. They take the two arms of a triangle. You see, they went up. To a little north of where the Mediterranean turns, beyond the river Orontes, onto the great river Euphrates. And when the Bible speaks of the great river, it almost always means the Euphrates, you see. Right onto there, and then down by the river Euphrates to the either to the Persian Gulf or striking across through Persia. You see. Now, Terah went up to Haran, which was halfway to Canaan. Abraham went. But God had said to Abraham before he left, now leave your family. And he didn't leave his family. He took them with him. And for that, on that account, he stuck. Because Terah wasn't going any further. No, he says, I'm biding here. And so Abraham, submissive to his father as they are in the east, he stuck too. And what did God do? He wanted Abraham to go on. He was only halfway there, up and down into Canaan. And so he took his father away. He died. And then he said to Abraham, now maybe you'll go now. And on he went. The devil, not being pleased with that, of course, because he was behind Abraham sticking halfway at Haran, he got Abraham to run out at the other end of the land. First, he wouldn't let him go in. You see, sticking up there at the top. You can see it in the map. You look at your Bibles and you see the map there. And then he shot him right through into Egypt. Anywhere but where God wanted him to be. That's the devil's idea, you see. Anywhere but where God wants you to be. Oh, we've got to watch him. So, he gets him out at the other end of the land, into Egypt, which, with Babylon, is another symbol for the ungodly world. Where, of course, as you know, Genesis 12 and... no, it's another reference. Later on, 13, I think. Where Abraham landed in trouble through his beautiful wife, Sarah. This is a sinister word in Genesis 12 and 9. And Abraham journeyed on, still going toward the Negev, which word means the south. You see? Abraham journeyed on, still going toward the Negev, because an evil principle working against the faith that was in him. The two fighting within him. He's a battlefield between God and the devil, you see. Driving him on into Egypt. It was there, you see, the king of Egypt took his wife and there was trouble. Now, Isaac had the same... Notice this is very important. Isaac had the same tendency to go on toward the south. Genesis 26, 1-5. Especially in time of testing. Let me stop now at... we come back to that perhaps. But let me stop at Isaac. But you find this in them all. They tended to go toward Egypt. Until God said, you all want to go to Egypt? I'll give you plenty Egypt yet. And he did, didn't he? You see the point? It was Satan. Now, Isaac, of course, was the miracle son of promise, whom God gave Abraham back from the dead on Mount Moriah as a type of the resurrection. Hebrews 11, 17-19. Very important verses. Jacob had the same fatal tendency, and his family, especially in time of famine. As later, much later on, you know the story of the book of Ruth, Naomi and Elimelech, they went to Moab, they crossed the Jordan and round the other side of the Dead Sea to Moab during the famine, because of course it was all almost fertile. It's a very, very fertile plateau, is Moab. 3,000-4,000 feet high, and they'd always grain. There never was famine in Moab. Always in Palestine. And they went to Moab during the famine. And God was displeased with his people for leaving the land he'd given them. He must never leave the land. He gave them the land for them to dwell in it, if they would behave themselves. And what did God do to poor Naomi? She took away her husband, Elimelech. She took away first one son, and then the other, and left her with two foreign daughters-in-law. And she said, it's time I went back to my own land. I'll lose everything. I'll lose my own life. And back she went. And Ruth went with her. The other one didn't. Orpah, isn't it? And that's why Ruth is in the genealogy of Christ and of David. Now, it's this tendency to go out of the land, which is the place of blessing, which is typical or symbolical to us, but was actual and vital to them, just as the furniture and the ark was not merely symbolical to them. It is to us, the ark and all the furniture. It was vital. Uzzah put his hand on the ark and he died. If the high priest had entered into the holiest place of all on any day but the Day of Atonement, or if he'd entered in without incense and without blood, he would have died like that. And if any beast had touched Mount Sinai, you see, when God was present giving the law, he would have died at once or been stoned to death or whatever, because these things were vital. And so it is vital to the Lord's people that they abide by his law, and that involves staying in the land. That's the place of blessing, Canaan. And they didn't do it. And so in the end, God said to Israel, you have a bias toward Egypt. To Egypt you shall go, and you'll stay there for 430 years. Cunning devil behind that, don't you think? But God has always his Moses. And Moses' part was to lead the Israelites out of Egypt when the nation was born on the night and morning of their departure, the Passover, you remember, which is itself a type of our salvation, the Passover being the primitive type of our communion service, with its eating the flesh of the spotless lamb and the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. The whole thing hangs together. There's nothing in the New Testament but you find the origins of in the Old Testament. They say there isn't a wisp of words in the book of the Revelation but is derived from the Old Testament. Basil Atkinson, who used to be the assistant librarian at Cambridge for many years. The dear man is with the Lord now. He was very emphatic about that. There wasn't a phrase in the book of the Revelation, but you could trace to the Old Testament, because the whole thing is one. In the Passover. And as Abraham foresaw the Christ that was to come, John 8:56, he saw my day and was glad, so did Moses. Who, Deuteronomy 18:15, said about Christ, prophesying about Christ, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet from among you, a prophet like me. That was 1,500 years before Christ came. Roundabout. 14, 13, argue with that. Him shall ye heed. God will raise up for you a prophet from among you, like me. Him shall ye heed. Let's run on then. From Moses, the crossing of the Red Sea, a miracle of God acclaimed so often in the Psalms and the Psalter, into the wilderness. The whole nation right into the wilderness to be trained and to receive the oracles of God at Sinai and the constitution and structure of the divine nation. Then right up into the promised land after they got the law and had been formed into a nation, marshaled and ordered according to their tribes. But no, they wouldn't go up into the land. And God said, all right, I say to you, go up. Don't you worry about these giants, the sons of Anak. I'll attend to them. Up you go. As Caleb and Joshua says, up you go. But they wouldn't go. God said, all right, you've lost your chance. You shall not go. And all the adults of Israel shall rot in the wilderness. Their carcasses will be spread out in the wilderness for 40 years. And then when you're all dead, your children will go in. Not by the front door, right up the Negev. You have to see the map to understand this. But by the back door, round the Dead Sea and over Jordan, and that's another water to cross. So if I could go back and trace right through all that again, the entail from the beginning, from Adam and the fall, the entail of repeated significant sins of man piles up until it becomes ever harder for God's people to go God's way. Could I just run through some of the significant sins of man that make it harder for God to fulfill his will? And of course the sins of man, behind the sins of men lies the devil. There's the fall itself, and then Cain and the murder, the marriages and the flood, Babel, Abraham and his sins, Isaac and his, Jacob and his, the brothers and Joseph, their refusal to enter into the land, that's a most significant sin. Their failure to subdue the land of Canaan, completely subdue it and keep the idolatrous people at bay. Their demand to have a king to be like other people. I'm going on beyond the stage we've got to, right on. Their demand, this is one of Israel's greatest sins. And of course the first king was a disaster. And all the kings, more or less, were failures. Even the best one made a fatal mistake, Josiah. And another significant sin, yes, these are the most important, I say, the fall, their refusal to enter into the land, not to speak of all their complaining in the wilderness. They're seeking a king. When God was their king, they said, you've got me for a king, you don't need a king. But when they demanded a king and ignored what God had said, the warnings in Deuteronomy, God said to Samuel, let them have their way. Oh, beware. Did I talk about this a fortnight ago? Beware of demanding your way from God. He'll maybe give you it and land you in trouble. They demanded a king. Then, the next most significant sin of Israel, from which we're all suffering in one sense, is the adultery of David and Solomon that led to the downfall of the nation. Now, you see, as you go as you go right through the Old Testament and see those particular, those significant sins that had influence on the whole nation and the course of history, you see what the devil is doing. He's not a tactician, he's a strategist. He's trying to destroy the people of Israel. You see? So, you see, the entail of repeated significant sins piles up until it becomes ever harder for God's people to do God's way. Will Satan beat God in the end? Never. But he will reduce God's people to the gutter. But first, before we come to that, to certain heights which God ordains as glorious types of the kingdom to come. Israel came into the land with the second giving of the law. That's what the word Deuteronomy means. They gave them it a second time on the threshold of the land before they crossed Jordan. And as they came into the land with the law, the second giving of the law, ringing in their ears, they proceed to make great but ultimately incomplete conquests under Joshua. But after him, the people sink law and all in their satchels, God's holy law they got in Sinai, repeated before they entered the land, and repeated again and written out up at the mounts of Gerizim and Ebal in the time of Joshua. Joshua had the whole thing written out, and he recited the whole thing to them again. And by the end of the book of Judges, they're living lives worse than the Canaanites, worse than the pagans. They've got the law in their satchels, but not in their hearts. If David had had the law of God in his heart, if he had had Genesis 2:24 in his heart, and Exodus 20:14, the seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, he wouldn't have landed in so much trouble, nor would Solomon, nor would the nation. You see? But they had the law and didn't keep it. As Paul says of the Jews in general in the letter to the Romans. Well then, they hadn't it in their hearts, they hadn't it even on their lips. And so, as we see in the book of Judges, they fall into ever greater sin until every man is doing what is right in his own eyes, worse than the Canaanites. That's the last sentence of the book of Judges. Then comes mighty Samuel, who turns the people back to God, 1 Samuel 7, hoping to marshal them successfully against the Philistines who are trying to capture their mountain home. You need a physical map of the land to see the ridge of Judah. It's a backbone running up and down the middle of the land of Palestine, there 2,000 to 3,000 feet above sea level. So they wanted a king to be like other nations, as I've said, whereas God said, I am your king. You're not to be like other folk, you're to be different. And when you're different, people will come to see what's different about you. Queen of Sheba, for instance. But they would have a king. They wouldn't wait for the real human king, who is Christ. So God said to Samuel, let them have their way. And they got it. And Saul, their first king, was a disaster and became a madman. Then came David. And the greater conquest of the land. We really would have needed a map. David took the land. Before that, God promised to let him into his seed the land of Canaan from Euphrates to the Nile and from the Mediterranean to Jordan, not beyond. But they've never occupied the whole land in all their life's history. And the nearest to it was in the day of David and Solomon after him, when David went as far north as Hamath, which is nearly up to the Euphrates, and down to Edom, that's Esau, south of the Dead Sea. Mostly they only occupied the middle bit of it. They've never occupied it at all. And, of course, this would be the argument of Orthodox Jews in the government of Jerusalem about Sinai towers. But whether they've forfeited the right to it morally is a question, but they might argue that way, you see. It's given to them. Genesis 15:18. Euphrates to the Nile, the great river to the Nile, you see. And now David made a conquest of land. He not only took the land there, but he subdued all the enemies round about. He went right round the enemies of Israel. Look, let's go round in a circle from the land. The Philistines, the Amalekites, the Edomites south of the Dead Sea, the Moabites, the Ammonites, you know, Ammon and Jordan and Hussein and all that, and the Syrians in the north. All these enemies, he subdued a whole list of them in the book of Samuel. And therefore, when Solomon came to the throne, to suit his name, which of course means peace, Solomon, Salam, Shalom, and Salem, Jerusalem, city of peace, he had a glorious reign of peace. No wars, practically no wars. And of course, David, that's why David and Solomon are together, for all their sins, are a dual type of Christ. Christ gaining victory over all the powers of evil, and then entering into his kingdom of peace. He's the Prince of Peace, you see, resting in its peace and glory. But nonetheless, these two men, by their adulteries, as I said, they had Genesis 2:24 and Exodus 20 and 14, sowed the seeds of the dissolution of the kingdom of Israel as a nation. See that long, is it the longest chapter in the Bible, Deuteronomy 28, where God says from the 16th verse onward, 15th verse onward, if you don't behave yourselves in that land, I'll put you out and I'll thrash you within an inch of your life, and I'll raise nation after nation after nation to thrash you. The Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians and the Seleucids, the Syrians. And he did. That's history. All to thrash God's people for their sins. He wouldn't cast them off. No divorce with him. He married them. He married Israel. Israel's his wife. He put her out of the house when she was unfaithful. Sent her to Babylon. But he took her back because he had covenanted to her to be her husband, as it were, forever. But he didn't let her off with unfaithfulness. He cast her out. And all this, in a sense, started with David and Solomon. And although that went on insidiously and then grossly for hundreds of years through the monarchy, at last the 10 northern tribes, then the 2 southern tribes, were taken away captive. The northern ones to Assyria, 721 B.C., the others Babylon in 3 different lots, but the last date is 586. And they came back around about 70 years later on, a mere remnant. Now I'm drawing, are we all right for time? I'm drawing to the close, and this is the most important part of what I want to say. They came back a mere remnant, and grew progressively poorer and more downtrodden among the nations. Now, I've given you a list of these nations. Until when Christ came. Now, listen to this. This is quite dramatic and romantic, too, in a sense. Until when Christ came, Israel's rightful king was born of a peasant maid in a highland outhouse. But Mary is the heir to the throne of Israel. And Joseph, they are co-heirs like William and Mary. Joseph, although he was just a joiner, was descended from Solomon. Trace it in Matthew 1, Luke 3. Mary was descended from another son of David's called Nathan, not the prophet, but Nathan. You get the genealogy of Joseph in Matthew and Mary, I believe, although some of the scholars argue with that, in Luke. You see? And so, the royal house of Judah is reduced to poverty because of the sins of the Jews and their remnant. Now, I've swept through all this, but the most important part of it, for a full understanding of who the Christ is, and what he came to do, and how he purposed to do it, is to understand the rise of Israel. From a man and a family to 12 tribes, then to a nation with varying fortunes, until they began to decline on account of their sin, and also fulfilled God's threat of losing their sovereignty as a nation. and as the supreme nation of the earth. Look, Daniel 2, 37, 38. You just need to note it down if you're writing, or note it down in your head, and listen while I read it. When the Jews were taken away captive from being the ascendant nation in the world, you see, at 1000 BC, Israel was the greatest nation on the earth. The Egyptians weren't great there, nor were the peoples of the east great in those days. Israel. That's why the Queen of Sheba came so far to see the glory of Solomon. Israel was at its zenith, and she was God's people, blessed of him. But when they sinned and sinned and sinned and were taken away captive, God said, you're demoted, down the class, down to the bottom of the class, out. And this is what we read in Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar, because God dismissed Israel, and in place of Israel he appointed the Babylonians and a pagan king as the principal king in the world, emperor, dictator, followed of course by the Persian, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans. And God says to Nebuchadnezzar here, you, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory, and into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the sons of men, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the air, making you rule over them all. That's terrific and tremendous. So the Jews are demoted, they're disgraced, they're humiliated, they're put down and become a mere remnant. And I believe the point of no return, as I see it, is with Ahab and Jezebel in Elijah's day, when God prematurely retired Elijah for wanting to do a Moses at Horeb or Sinai. And he went to do it. Now follow this closely. And God said, he was not in the earthquake, or the wind, or the fire, of a return to national supremacy or glory, but he was in the still small voice of the remnant. Which idea Elisha was to understand better than Elijah. And so the nation, after that, through the schools of the prophets, begun by Samuel but developed by Elisha, perpetuated prophetic insight and godly light through the captivities. First with the writing prophets Amos and Hosea. Then nearly 200 years after that, by Isaiah, who saw that God was intent on reducing Israel to a remnant. Now, here's the significant references in Isaiah to the remnant. Isaiah 1:17, just a hint. Isaiah 8:16 and 17, although the word remnant is not used there, what happens there is that God says to Isaiah, shut the book, stop preaching to Israel, don't let them get it, shut it up, and take your disciples away in a corner and speak to them, and don't let the nation hear. They don't deserve to hear anymore. Shut the book. That's what he said. Then significant verses about the remnant. Chapter 10, verses 20 to 22. Chapter 11, verses 11 and 16, etc. Now, this idea of the remnant, by the time of Jeremiah, 100 years later on, roundly, is common coin. When the last two tribes were about to be carried away, you get note of the remnant in Jeremiah 15:11, 23:2, 31:7, 39:9, etc., etc. And of course, through the centuries that followed, I'm running through centuries now, the fact had to be swallowed through all the vicissitudes, until the great people of God are reduced to peasantry, and the ultimate one, the anointed King of Israel, and King of kings and Lord of lords, by his triumph over the devil who tried to drag him and his people into the gutter, and even destroy the Christ child even after he is on the earth. Compare Revelation 12, 1 to 6. He comes himself and against all the hellish odds of the devil's hatred of Christ, Christ does the deed, snatches the victory, and returns to heaven until the victory of his faith, which he gained for us, is put into operation by us in each generation, until all his enemies are put under his feet and he comes to reign. You see, Christ has gone back to heaven to wait until we subdue the kingdom by our faith. Not in total, but in our day and generation. Your responsibility and mine is to win people for Christ. Have them built up in the faith of Christ. And at last, taken to heaven, and so progressively through the centuries and through the generations, until all enemies are put under his feet. He's there. Why is he there waiting till it's done? Because he's done all he can do. We've to do the rest. So that the most important idea in the struggle between God and the devil, and between sin and faith in the chosen race in the Old Testament, is that of the reduction of the nation to a remnant. Which idea Elijah couldn't stomach. But Isaiah saw it. And by the time of Jeremiah, it's commonplace and has to be swallowed and accepted. Now, to climax all this, even the second Elijah, Malachi 4, verses 4 and 5, you know that the Old Testament ends with the promise of Elijah coming again, and Jesus said that was John the Baptist. Second Elijah, John the Baptist, the greatest and last of the Old Testament prophets, and Jesus said there never was a greater man than he, had the same difficulty as earlier Elijah had in accepting the idea of the remnant. Now, and I finish with this, and I give you these two references I mentioned. Matthew 11, 1 to 6. I find a great many Christians can't take this in. They find this so incredible. Even they don't believe what they read in the Word about Elijah and Elisha and John the Baptist and Jesus. And you see, the importance of this is related to the word we use in the Greek for church, which is ecclesia, which comes from the word in its prefix, ekkaleo, to call out. And the church is a company of the called out ones, called out from the world. You see? And that idea started, you see, in Israel. God chose a remnant. Now, to understand this, you need to read something that I discussed the other year here, Romans 9 to 11. Read all that to understand what is meant by that. You see, but here it is coming up in the New Testament. And of course, the point about all this is that if you don't understand this, you can't understand the church's place. You'll have a false idea of what the church is meant to do in the world and what you're meant to do in the world. One of the greatest satisfactions I have had in the course of my ministry is to understand what the Lord wanted his church to do and what he expected me to do and what he didn't expect me to do. Anyway, look at it here. John the Baptist is in prison, Matthew 11 and 1 or 2. When John heard in prison about the deeds of the Christ, and that's the right name for tonight, isn't it? He sent word by his disciples and said to him, now this is the man, John the Baptist, who had baptized Jesus in Jordan and said, behold the Lamb of God that taketh away the sins of the world. But now languishing in prison and maybe suffering from depression, but that's not the whole story. He says, are you he who is to come, or shall we look for another? Now if anything could express clearer his disappointment with Jesus, I would like to know what it is. The reports he'd heard about what Jesus was doing after he's in prison didn't please him. Some people try to put it on to his disciples. They think this couldn't be true of John. Well, believe the sight of your eyes, what you're reading. Are you he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Jesus answered him, Go tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, and the lame walk. Lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have the good news preached to them. And blessed is he who takes no offense at me, John. Now, what does that mean? Jesus is going around healing and helping individuals. John was a national evangelist. The bigwigs from Jerusalem came to hear him, and some of them were baptized by him. He was a national evangelist. He was seeking, as Elijah was, the return of the nation, the re-establishment of the nation, the repentance of the nation. And doubtless, although he wasn't politically minded in the political sense, to throw off the yoke of Rome. Who wouldn't? But turn to chapter 12 and look at verse 14 as an introduction to 15. The Pharisees went out and took counsel against him how to destroy him after Jesus healed the man, the withered hand of the man. Jesus, aware of this, withdrew from there, and many followed him. And he healed them all, and ordered them, are you listening? Not to make him known. Don't give it to the mass media. Shh. Are you reading on? This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. Description of Christ and his character and his ministry, the nature of his ministry. Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved, with whom my soul is well pleased. I like this kind of man, says Jesus, says God. I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall proclaim justice to the Gentiles. The gospel is going to be sent broadcast beyond the Jews, many of whom don't want it. But to do so, to preach to Jews or Gentiles, he will not wrangle or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. He will not break a bruised reed. Jock, you prayed beautifully about our being gentle and not harsh at the beginning of the meeting. He will not break a bruised reed or quench a smoldering wick till he brings what? As you read up to that point, you think, oh, he's such a gentle, timid little creature like Jeremiah that he wouldn't hurt a fly. And he would not have the slightest effect on anyone. He's too gentle, he's too simple. But notice the sequence. Oh, take him. The meaning of the words. He will not wrangle or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. He will not break a bruised reed or quench a smoldering wick, till he brings justice to victory. Gently does it for victory. And in his name will the Gentiles hope. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal. We don't employ worldly, that is, methods which were inspired by Satan, using the things of this world. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but being spiritual, although unseen, and not spectacular in the eyes of the world, and not known in the eyes of the world, are mighty to the pulling down of strongholds. This is what we learn, amongst other things, in the Old Testament, that God's purpose and the sins of the Jews and Satan's machinations are all used for it. God's purpose is, having raised the people of Israel to the zenith of their glory and power in David and Solomon, bring them down again because of the sin, right down, right down, right down, right to come to the very bottom, until he comes to reign from the tree in simplicity, despising the shame, and sends his disciples out, the called out companies, to make known his grace and his will, and to win individual souls, numbers if one can, and build up the kingdom until heaven. As I was saying, is bulging. And it must come. The kingdom must come. This is the biblical concept of the church and of Christ. And I would bid you take these two passages again and look at them and compare them and see where Elijah and John the Baptist misunderstood the nature of the work that God has for us to do in the world. And I would say, by way of encouragement to you, if you're sometimes discouraged because you don't see perhaps as a union all you'd like to see, we would like to see great things, and I believe the day of great things may be in the future for us. There are signs, there are encouraging signs, but God is always drawing people to himself, building them up. Every day there are those being brought to him, beginning to grow and hunger. I'm absolutely thrilled as I go over the country, the number of people, some very recent converts, who have almost a gnawing hunger for God's word. Ones and twos it may be. The day of greater things may be to come. As you go out into the world in your professions, but whether or not God's work goes on through thick and thin, through revival and times of darkness and difficulty and coldness and deadness, God's work goes on. You trace it right through the Old Testament, right through the Bible. Gently does it. But if it is with the Spirit, it's mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. Amen.